as a general rule, I record my talk, my classes, except when I forget to, as I did Monday. That's partly so that students who miss a class because they're sick or something can hear it, partly so if you want to review something you can, and partly so that somebody 1,000 miles away you'd like to sit in this class can do so. If anybody has any problems with the fact that the things you say may get recorded as well, let me know and I'll figure out what I can do with it about that I find it a convenient arrangement. I thought I would start by very briefly repeating the stuff I said Monday about the mechanics of the class, then discuss some general issues having to do with the stuff we're covering, including a variety of thread topics, many of which don't have chapters, which are worth thinking about anyway, other things, issues that run through lots of legal systems, and then go on to talk about the gypsies. And I hope at that point that you'll do some of the talking too. One of the disadvantages of having written the book, or at least a draft of a book, is that you've now already read most of what I have to say about these things, and therefore, if we want anything new and interesting, you're supposed to contribute. You might also think about whether there are threads that I haven't mentioned that ought to be covered, whether there are common issues as we go through these legal systems, if there are common issues that didn't occur to me, but that occur to you and might be worth discussing. So, to repeat the sort of basics, all useful information should be on the website, and the website is found by going to my website, which I gave the URL for last time. If anyone didn't get it, ask me after class, and then following the link that goes to this class's website. By now, you probably all have it bookmarked, so I'm really wasting my time telling you again. Your major requirement for this course is a paper. That paper will usually consist of doing the same thing I'm doing in my chapters, but for a different legal system. But there are a number of other possible papers you could write, which I mentioned before. The draft of that paper, sufficiently substantial draft so we can discuss it, is due on April 2nd. And the final draft of the paper is due on the last day of exam period. All right. Papers that I like, I will ask permission to leave up on my website for future students and anybody else who's interested. Obviously, I won't do that without your permission. But I am assuming that any paper draft submitted, I can put up at least long enough for the other students in the class to look at it, since that's part of the process. I think that's everything along sort of the mechanics side. Do you have any questions before I go on to substantive questions? Yes? I expect that things are usually going to come in to me as email. That's most convenient. And April 2nd ends at midnight. General note on sources, since some of the stuff you're getting from secondhand through me, but some of it you're getting from the places I got it, various books you're reading. As a general rule, we're more interested in what the source tells us about a legal system than in what the author's conclusions are about it. One of the patterns I observed in developing this course is that authors are typically biased in favor of whatever system they're describing. You can observe that in me. If you read my Icelandic piece, it should be clear that I rather like the Icelanders. I think it was a neat system, less crazy than it appears to moderns at first glance. And I think you will see the same thing if you read, for example, the book I've used in the past, but not this year, on Cheyenne Law. It's clear that the authors writing in the 1930s really think quite highly of the Cheyenne Indians, perhaps correctly. I noticed a number of other examples of that sort. You can see it in the Gypsy Law book, where you will notice that at least the editor, who I think is provides in some ways one of the less well-done chapters, is very concerned that we not be prejudiced against gypsies, and we recognize that, well, you know, doing this is some people's culture, and stealing chickens is other people's culture, and therefore you shouldn't be prejudiced against them, and so forth and so on. And I think most of that stuff you can filter out. It's not very informative. The interesting question is, how does their system work, and what can you say about it? Also, of course, people writing on one legal system are not necessarily expert on other legal systems. And one of the more amusing cases I noticed there in the book on Chinese law that you'll be reading parts of is that the authors go to some length to argue that Imperial Chinese law was really not as barbaric as people think it was. Why? Compare it to the English Bloody Code, in which they hang everybody. And of course, I would say, well, the English Bloody Code was not as barbaric as people think about it. It was. Most of them didn't hang people. And besides, look at the Chinese and what they did, which I thought was sort of an interesting contrast. One further issue, which I think comes up in general and which you want to think about in any future research you do, is that especially if the subject is one where only a few people are studying it, it's hard to know how much you can trust them. In particular, you may find that different sources give noticeably different opinions. One of the things that struck me reading the Gypsy Law stuff is that it's not at all clear in the different comments on it in different parts of that book, which are chapters written by different people, exactly how the Cris Romagna, the court system, decides its verdict. That in one place it sounds as though what's going on is you have explicit judges, maybe one judge or a small number of judges, and they decide what happens. And in others it really sounds more as though they talk it to consensus and the judges are reporting the consensus. And it may well be that one of them is true in some areas, one another. In general, one can't be sure what's right. Similarly, I have in the reading list, though not as a required reading, a book on Iceland, on Saga Period Iceland, by a scholar at University of Michigan called William Miller, and his view of my views is not entirely positive, whether correctly or not. There was a brief period of time when we were both at University of Chicago Law School, and it occurred to me that the University of Chicago Law School might be subject to antitrust suits at that point, since they had established a monopoly of all legal scholars interested in Saga Period Iceland. Only briefly. He was only visiting at the time. But in any case, just remember what I hope you've learned by now in your life. Nobody can be trusted. All right. One of the nice things about the web, in my opinion, is that the web is so obviously an open medium that unless you're brain dead, you realize that some of the stuff on it isn't true. That there's sort of a tendency to say, well, I read it in a book, it must be true. Or my teacher told it to me, it must be true. And that's a very dangerous tendency. And ultimately, you have to cultivate the ability to figure out for yourself what's probably true. And part of that, if you're reading the web, is this page written by someone who cares whether what he says is true or not? And you can often tell, because people who care whether something is true mention the evidence against their thesis. They qualify their statements in various ways and so forth. Whereas people who know that God has delivered the truth to them on a silver platter tend to put it in very strong terms. Anyway, those are all sort of general comments. I should say one of the other cases that I noticed more recently having to do with different sources is with the Amish. Because with the Amish, the old big settlement is Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It turns out, if you read enough, that it's in a number of ways a rather atypical settlement. But at least some of the books on the Amish are written by people who are really describing the Lancaster settlement and occasionally mention in a footnote, by the way, we've just said isn't really true about all Amish. And so I think you have interesting problems there. I think the best source I found on that was a book that was simply a description of every Amish settlement in the state of Indiana. Its history, how it worked, and so forth. And that worked because Indiana is not where it's not the original settlement, so they've got, as it were, daughter settlements from here and daughter settlements from there, and thus they cover the whole range from the people who are sort of marginally Amish at all to the Schwarzentruppers, who are the really hardline people who don't think they should have to put warning marks on the backs of their buggies at night because that's much too show-offy for proper Amish style. All right, let me say a little bit about what seemed to me to be common threads running through these. One of them is the whole issue of enforcing law. How do you do it? Whose job is it? Is law enforced by professional prosecutors and police, by the victim, as in our tort system, victim and his lawyer, what you're going to be doing, some of you, or is it enforced directly by private actors as in a feud system? All of these are possibilities. We'll see all of them. What's the incentive to prosecute? Why do people bother to enforce the law? State employee bureaucracy, that's the Chinese system, that's our criminal law system. In exchange for a damage payment, that's our tort system, but that's also the Icelandic, and to some extent, as you'll be seeing, the gypsy in some variants of gypsy law for a bounty. All right, that was the American Wild West, you know, $100 dead or alive story, but that also describes Athenian public cases, as you'll see. And one of the more interesting ones, which we'll be getting to with regard to 18th century English, is extortion. That is to say, why do I prosecute you in order that I can get you to pay me to stop? All right. Well, from one side, that sounds like a rather unattractive arrangement. On the other hand, it does give somebody incentive to prosecute. I've even seen the argument made that we really shouldn't make blackmail illegal, because what's blackmail? It's just a way of paying private prosecutors. They get paid by the victim. He's paid his fine. The prosecutor collects his money. Don't need to hire any police. So, but different variants of that system where people prosecute in order to be paid to drop charges certainly happens in our system. A lot of out-of-court settlements in the tort system, and it happens in other places. So that's going to be one issue. And then the flip problem to the problem of getting enough incentive is the problem of having too much incentive. And we'll be seeing a number of cases, and people who follow controversies in the U.S. at the moment, or for the last, 20 years, know that there are at least some people who think that there's a lot of unjustified suing in the hope of getting big rewards or big out-of-court settlements from people with deep pockets. So that's another issue. And as I mentioned, one interesting question that we'll get back to is, are there ways of avoiding the problem of either too much or too little incentive other than the size of the incentive? Can you do it by somehow setting up your legal system so that it's more profitable to sue people when they're guilty? And to some extent, the answer is, of course, that's why we have trials with evidence and all the rest of it, but there may be other and more subtle or less obvious ways in which you can do that. I'm going to argue that it will be. Going back from what is the question of enforcing verdicts in a feud system, it's by private action. That actually seems to be a very, very common system, historically speaking, that it's one of the gypsy systems. It's the Icelandic system we'll discuss. It's pretty clearly a good deal of the ancient Irish system. If you look at Jewish law and you read it carefully, and for that matter Muslim law as well, both of them look as though they're legal systems constructed on sort of the fossils of a feud system. That I don't know if any of you are familiar in Jewish law with the idea of cities of refuge or the avenger of blood. That these are terms that you're still seeing in Maimonides at a time when there's been no city of refuge for well over 1,000 years, but he's describing the whole... One of the weird things about Maimonides is you're not quite sure if he simply assumes that we're going to get Israel back next week, and therefore I might as well describe the whole legal system, complete with the temple, which hasn't been around for 1,000 years, complete with the cities of refuge, which haven't been around for 1,500 years or whatever, or whether it's just that he's sort of a theoretical completist and he figures if he's going to tell the law, he's going to tell all the law, even though half of it has nothing to do with the modern world. But anyway, if you look at it, you see what looks as though there was at one point a system where it was the job of the kin of the victim to avenge the killing, and then bits of that are left over in the modern system. And the same thing is true in Sharia. That, as we will see, one of the features of Sharia is that one part of it pretty clearly is Bedouin blood feud law, civilized, as it were. Bedouin blood feud law with a overlay of a sort of a court system for settling matters, but in which if you kill someone and his kin don't sue you, in theory, nothing happens to you. If you injure someone and he chooses not to prosecute, in theory, nothing happens to you. It's, in effect, that part of Sharia is treating death and injury as civil offenses, not as criminal offenses. And they're ones where the victim can forgive you, and then there's no penalty. And in certain cases, the victim can insist on your being killed. Others he can't, depends on the circumstances. But anyway, that's sort of interesting, the feel one gets that maybe the original legal system of mankind, as it were, is feud, and then everything else is developed out of that in varying ways. Anyway, another system that you have, another set of issues that you have, is how do you fill in gaps in the law? That no legal system is ever complete. And as we will see in China, one way of doing it is by analogy, by saying, well, this offense is very much like this offense in the statutes, but it's less serious, so let's give a slightly lower penalty, that kind of thing. But meanwhile, China also had the doctrine that doing what ought not to be done was a crime. So you could get some of you if it wasn't in the statute book. And my favorite one is violating an imperial decree, which did not require that the decree existed. Violating an imperial decree essentially meant, well, if the emperor had thought about this question, he would have made a rule against it. Therefore, we can punish you for doing it. So it was an imaginative system. In Athens, similarly, there was a special court for crimes there was no law against, which is really the same principle. In Jewish law, as we will see, although you start out with Torah, you start out with quite an extensive legal system based on the Old Testament, you then have some ingenious ways of expanding or contracting that when the legal scholars thought it was necessary to do so. Get more details on that later. But my favorite version, the very best way of cheating I've come across, is something called the Doctrine of the Oral Torah. The written Torah is the first, I think, six books or seven books of the Old Testament. The oral Torah is what God told Moses on Mount Sinai. And Moses passed it on by word of mouth to later legal scholars up to the present time being, say, 100 B.C. or something like that. And therefore, they can explain how to interpret the written Torah. And it's not always the way that you might interpret it if you just read it. So that's sort of a neat, like a get-out-of-jail blank check kind of thing on for modifying the legal system. But anyway, then another problem which you have to worry about is the general issue of litigants gaming the system in both directions, of people who've done bad things but can figure out some legal trick to get out of it, which is something that people worry about in our system a good deal, and the flip side of that, people who can use the system to get their enemies or to get money or to do other things, whether or not anybody is really guilty of that. And my favorite solution to that is the Icelandic solution, and that is that when you get really irritated about the way the guy has been manipulating the legal system after he killed your brother and is trying to get out of paying for it, you kill him. And then the money his heirs owe you, you give them back to them, and you're all even. And there's a famous chunk of one of the best-known sagas, Njal's Saga, where you have two women who hate each other, and their husbands are good friends. And one of the women gets one of the men in her household to go kill somebody in the household of the other woman. And so her husband hands over a bag of silver to the other woman's husband as wergeld, as blood money. The wife, however, is not satisfied, so she arranges to have the guy who did the first killing killed. Bag of silver goes back. And I think there are a total of about six people killed before the whole thing is over with the same bag of silver. I think it changes the amount according to the status of the people being killed, going back and forth. But the two men still remain friends. So. Anyway, that's Njal's Saga is quite a lot of fun. It's got a couple of my favorite stories in it. If you want to read sagas, Egil's Saga is readable and not that long. Njal's Saga is readable much longer. But they give you a sort of a first-hand view of a very different society in literature that's survived for 800 years in print, in English, in translation, in paperbacks, which is impressive. Anyway, another issue which comes up in our legal system and all others is to what extent do you judge the outcome versus the actor? In other words, am I liable because I caused injury, or am I liable because I acted badly? And that's, in some sense, very loosely our negligence versus strict liability distinction. It's also a criminal versus civil distinction, because at least in theory, you can't commit a crime without mens rea, without having had intent. Now, if you think about it for a while, you can probably think of some things that are crimes that you can, in fact, that are treated as strict liability crimes. But that's not sort of the theoretical structure of it. Whereas in tort, I can be liable for an injury, not because I did anything badly. Maybe I had to be negligent, maybe I didn't. So there are lots of strict liability torts. So that's a distinction which runs through. Is accidental killing the same thing as murder? Or one of the ones that I like, flipping it over, why is there a difference between the punishment for murder and for attempted murder? That after all, if the punishment is for being a bad person, being a bad shot is not a moral virtue. So why do we think you're a better person if you missed than if you hit? If the punishment is for damage, then why do we punish attempted murder at all? I missed. The bullet went into a tree. The tree is fine. The guy who was shooting at it is fine. Why do I owe anything? All right. so that's sort of an interesting puzzle that's worth thinking about legal systems in many different contexts. And you can see which ones do it. And in our system, insanity is a defense for a criminal act, but it is not a defense for a tort act. Another distinction which runs through our system but varies others is the distinction between bright line rules and standards. All right, a bright line rule says you did it or you didn't do it. You cannot run for president if you're less than 35. And it's clearly a silly rule, if you think about it, that we can surely think of people who are more than 35 who are less qualified to be president than other people who are less than 35. We might even think of people who are more than 35 who got elected president who were elected less. Which ones will depend on our particular views of the various previous presidents, but almost all of us could find at least one we thought shouldn't have gotten it. On the other hand, if the rule was a standard, if the rule was you must be mature enough to do the job of president, then that really means that presidents are chosen by the Supreme Court. Because that's where that case will eventually necessarily, as in some past cases, end up. So that's an example of a bright line versus a standard, and you can see across all legal systems, in effect, that standards, if done right, give you a more sensitive, a better adjusted system, but they require somebody to make the judgment, and how do you get the right person to make the judgment? And my very rough impression is that systems where you've got somebody at the top with discretion are more likely to use standards. And systems where power is very dispersed, like a feud system, are more likely to use bright lines. Because after all, if you and I are legal equals, and there is no legal superior over us, and I think you've done something wrong, and you think you haven't, how are we going to settle it? But if I think you smashed that window, it's going to be hard for you to deny that you smashed the window. That's a fact. So there's something to be said when you have decentralized enforcement systems for using bright line rules despite their obvious disadvantages. And another interesting issue, which I sort of noticed in a number of these things, is how, if you want to run a centralized legal system, do you prevent it from changing into feudalism? That is, the problem is, suppose you've got a big centralized system, I'm thinking of Imperial China. As a practical matter, the emperor can't do everything. He can't pay attention to everything. In Chinese law, there were various things. I think theoretically, any death sentence had to be confirmed by the emperor. But there's just no way he could really have read the facts. So it really means some subordinate of his is doing it. Or in some cases, being done by chance. There's a sort of a semi-random mechanism for some of that. So that means you've got to give a good deal of authority to people farther down. In the Chinese system, you have district magistrates. And the district magistrate is really sort of chief of police, mayor, judge combined. If people want a picture of that, by the way, for some more light reading, since we all know that law students have lots and lots of free time, there's a set of books by a Dutch sinologist called Van Gulik, who decided, he was sort of upset over the fact that Chinese and Japanese students, this may have been either before or after World War II, it was a fair while back, were reading a lot of translations of very junky Western detective stories and didn't know that there was a whole literature of Chinese detective stories. And so he decided to do something about it. And he did one book that was essentially a translation, he put together pieces of a couple of different things of such a thing, and he then did a series of books which are sort of mixture of novel and short stories, the so-called Judge Dean mysteries, which are in print. They're fairly popular mysteries, they're good books, but they're all set in Imperial China. The Sherlock Holmes figure is Judge Dee, who was a magistrate, a famous magistrate, a famous Chinese tradition. And you can see sort of, again, it's not literally firsthand, because Van Gulik is a modern person, but he was an expert on the period. One of the books, actually, that has stuff on Chinese law is also by him. And you get a sort of picture of how that system worked. And then you have to worry about it. If you're the emperor, if you're the emperor's political theorist thinking about the system, you say, wait a minute, these magistrates have all of this authority in their area. How are we going to prevent a situation where over time they become de facto rulers and people look at them and not at us, and our reports are all being filtered through people who are loyal to them and so forth and so on? And that's a system, a problem that many systems, when they're trying to maintain. Sorry, drop somebody else, Ken, that was sitting here. that many systems that are trying to maintain centralized authority have. And there are a number of interesting solutions. One of the Chinese solutions was you move them around. You're only allowed to be magistrate in a given district for, I think, 3 years. Furthermore, you're not allowed to marry within your district, so that's going to make it a little harder to set up alliances via marital alliances and things of that sort. The Ottoman Empire, which we're not going to cover, but I've read about, had this sort of, I thought, rather clever solution. And that is the Ottomans are fighting some local prince, and they beat him. So what do they do with him? Do they cut his head off? That would make the next local prince fight even more desperately against them. Besides, it's a waste. You've got this confident guy. He's been running his own principality just fine, well enough to put up a fight against you. No. You give him a job at the other end of the Ottoman Empire, running some other part of the Ottoman Empire under the Sultan. He doesn't have any local support, so he depends on the central government's authority. But on the other hand, he's still rich. He's still, you know, at the top of the heap. And therefore, the next prince says, well, maybe I should surrender instead of fighting this desperate battle. They give pretty good jobs to the guys who surrender. So I thought that was sort of an ingenious way of trying to solve this particular problem. Another problem in all systems is how do you make law, how do you change law, and that again is an issue that runs through many different legal systems, legislature in our system, for us, for Athens, for Iceland. Iceland had a legislature that made law. You can have judges do it by interpretation in parts of our system, in the traditional British common law system. You can have it deduced by scholars. The case of both Islamic law and Jewish law, you basically have some body of stuff you're starting with, and then legal scholars figure out what the law is for there. Is there an American equivalent of that? Is there a case in our legal system where people who are not judges and are not legislators are de facto making law? Who do it? What do we call them? Yep. Administrators, but they're still, yeah, but they're the, you're right, that's a legitimate example, though not the one I was thinking of. Yep. What? Juries don't make law, they only give verdicts, right? The jury result is not precedent. I was thinking of the American Law Institute, the ALI, which is, that's where the restatements come from, all right? The third restatement of torts, or whatever it's called at the moment. What, fourth now? Is a statement by a bunch of legal experts of what they think tort law is or ought to be. And it has considerable influence, although it has no legal authority, and yet it has considerable influence on both legislatures and judges. So that's really analogous to the way in which Islamic or Jewish law is made. Again, part of the fun of all of this is seeing to what degree what seem like exotic ways of doing things actually run through our system, too. It's just we don't think of them in that way. And then another issue is jurisdiction. Who does the law apply to? And how does the law interact with other authority structures, with family, with firms, with other nations' laws, and so forth? All right, those were the things that I was sort of going to give as an expanded list of threads, many of which aren't in the book, and maybe someday will be, maybe won't. Let me now stop for a moment, since you've now read stuff on... Stop first so that if any of you have a clever idea of something I've left out, is there another thread that one ought to think about that has occurred to any of you? And you don't have to do it in real time. You can email me. Yeah.
Well, I just have a basic question, I guess, backing up to a bunch of the different laws that we're looking at.
Yeah.
There certainly is. It is church law. The Catholic Church ran its own system of courts right through the Middle Ages. For all I know, it still does. It could have as much influence as it used to. What? Yeah, canon law. Yeah. No. I guess from my standpoint, I'm willing to define it pretty broadly. That I'm really interested in ways in which rules are enforced, as it were. So that from my standpoint, private norms are a system of law. Even though they aren't usually called law. But the reasons that it is imprudent for me to teach this class trip to the waist really is a legal system. There will be negative consequences to me for behaving in ways in which university professors aren't supposed to behave. All right, that's a fairly extreme case, but it nonetheless is a real one. And one of the ones which I don't think we'll be discussing in this class, but which I've discussed elsewhere, is the
book by Ellickson, Order Without Law, about Shasta County, California, where the law of the state of California doesn't run for certain issues. Why? Because there are well-defined norms of neighborly behavior. They settle what your obligations are when your cattle eat my tomato crop. And one of those norms is neighbors don't sue each other. And therefore, the actual tort law rules have very little effect. So that seems to me it makes sense to think of that as a legal system. And part of my excuse for thinking about it as a legal system is that a system like that really raises ultimately the same sorts of issues as other legal systems. So that I have a old Journal of Political Economy article, which is basically on the question of why legal systems use inefficient punishments. Why don't we structure every punishment in the way that minimizes punishment costs? So, for example, a fine is a much more efficient punishment than imprisonment. Furthermore, if you really think it through, execution is more efficient than imprisonment, too. Because, after all, execution in a system that takes it seriously. In our system, execution is expensive because we're very reluctant to do it. But in systems like 18th century England that do it pretty routinely, what is the cost of execution? One life. Who pays the cost? The criminal. What is the size of the punishment? The size of the punishment, from the standpoint of deterrence, is the cost paid by the criminal. All right? So executing one person is in some sense equivalent to putting 10 people in jail for 5 years each, if you think about the deterrent effect. Imagine you're thinking about either catching one criminal in 10 and executing him, or catching 10 out of 10 and putting him in jail for 5 years. Those might have roughly similar effects. And yet, if the summed cost to the criminals is the same in both cases, but the cost to the rest of us, in one case, is no cost at all except for the wage of the hangman, and the other we got to pay for a jail for all that time. So there's a very real sense in which execution is more efficient than in imprisonment. Penal slavery, if you can make it work, is more efficient than execution. Executing people and having their organs forfeit for transplant is more efficient than execution. Why don't we do all these things? All right. For that matter, flogging people is more efficient than imprisonment. Just like execution, all the cost is borne by them, pretty much. Right? Maybe you can even sell tickets. And yet we don't. And the basic argument that I made there is the reason that we're reluctant to do these things is that we have to worry about the incentives of the enforcers as well as the enforcees. And that the more it is profitable for me to punish you, the greater my incentive to try to grab control over the legal system and use it to benefit myself at your expense. That's the underlying problem. And the interesting thing is that one of my favorite examples is from Shasta County. Because in Shasta County, when my neighbor has violated the norms, when he keeps letting his cattle stray into my crop and not doing anything about it, the ultimate sanction is that instead of calling him up, I drive his cattle out of my property, head the direction away from his farm, and drive them as far as I'm willing to go. Then I go home and let him find his cattle. All right? That's imposing a cost. But it's also a nuisance to me. This is a rural county. Why don't I just convert one of his 10 cows into hamburger in my freezer and then call him up to tell him that 9 of his cattle have trespassed on my land? He'd get the point after a while, right? Why don't I do it? Because it would pay me to do that even if he were innocent. Even if he had only broken the rules once or twice and not enough to justify a serious punishment. So that's exactly the same problem, the same issue, that where punishments are too profitable, you have to worry about too much of an incentive to impose it. And I discovered eventually that Larry Niven, who is a very well-known science fiction author, had made just that point some time ago in a series of short stories about organ forfeiture. In which, in the first of those stories, somebody is in prison awaiting execution. He mentioned sort of at the preface to the story, the sequence of legal events by which it occurred to people in various countries that there was a shortage of organs, and that it's really wasteful to hang somebody and bury him. That when you're executing someone, it's the ideal circumstance for getting organs, because he was alive until the last moment, so why not take advantage of it? And in Niven's fictional history, one country after another follows this path. And then if you think about it, you can see what happens, which is there's still a shortage of organs. Well, we know how to take care of a shortage of organs, right? We just have to increase the number of capital offenses. And at the end of this short story, you discover that the protagonist who's in prison waiting execution has been convicted for the third time of driving in such a way as to endanger human life. So 3 dangerous driving convictions, and you're dead. All right. So it's exactly my point. In this case, it's the political incentive to change the law to expand the range of capital punishments. So from my standpoint, that's just as much an issue for systems of norms as for legislated law, as for religious law, and so forth. And so it seems to me it makes sense to sort of pool all of the things which raise this set of issues together rather than trying to sharply distinguish them. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, I'd say, when I'm talking about legal systems, for me, what is the difference? Talk about Jackson County and having a lawless system and enforcing stuff there is possible to do it there. Once you expand the scale of, say, Imperial China, then each of these legal systems has a certain threshold at this point in the 64. Or even in a modern sense, if you look at a place like Luxembourg, a single welfare state you can create in a country that's the size of Oakland,
yep.
And then trying to take those principles and adapt them to California or the United States as a whole, like.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that suggests that one possible thread topic that hadn't occurred to me is scaling effects. That some things scale and some don't. I'm used to thinking of that in the economic context because I'm willing to argue that Stalinist central planning works on a scale of 10 people. And that the reason ultimately why the Soviet system broke down is that central planning systems don't scale and markets do. But I would take your comments as conjectures, not as facts. That is to say, I don't really know over how large an area systems of norms can work. I don't really know what will. But it's a question worth asking. I agree. It's an interesting question. Yeah.
For you, in different legal systems, there are some laws that are considered to be higher quality or more significant than others. In our case, we have the Constitution versus law revised by Congress. We're not alone in having this idea. Some laws as being
absolutely
really important and not easily changeable. And that becomes a very interesting question, especially because you get people who come along and say, that's the law I want to change. I mean, especially when you talk about term limits, you're talking about constraining the Supreme Executive Authority. Mm. It's like, that's the first one they want to get rid of.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting problem. With that.
Well, similarly, think about the whole question of birthright citizenship at the moment. All right, you can make some arguments about interpretation, but I think most people would agree that that's a constitutional principle, and yet you can see why people who have reservations about immigration are bothered about the idea that somebody comes into this country, has a baby, and boom, the baby ultimately gets citizenship. So that's another one. Yeah, one of the odd things that you get in Jewish law, actually, is the idea that some laws are of lower status than others, and because they're of lower status, you're less restricted in passing them. So that you have this idea in a number of places of Jewish law of Torah says we can't do X. We're going to do X. But we're not going to claim it's real sort of permanent law. It's just a temporary rule which has been in for the last 400 years. Right? So that's, in a sense, something that you get. And I suspect that an equivalent might be sort of administrative regulations in our system, that you might have cases where people were less constrained in administrative regulations than they were in things they called laws. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So, well, ethnologically, I guess, who can own property? Who does wealth of property get passed on to?
And who has what rights in marriage? Inheritance?
The women in their skirts and they
yes.
To that. And then formal and informal, role of gossip in society.
Right. Yeah. No. Gender roles would be an interesting subject, and it's not one I've thought an awful lot about, maybe because too many other people do, and therefore it didn't strike me as that exciting. But no, it's true. And part of the issue is that we're in such a very weird legal system. I mean, we're in, to first approximation, this is the only society in the history of the world which has got this bizarre idea that men and women are the same. Right, I'm sure there's somewhere you could find an example, but the other is much, much more typical. And it would be interesting to ask, what are the common elements of that? Presumably you could try to argue, what are the reasons for that? Is it functional? Is it just because the men are bigger and stronger and they get their way? Is it because until modern times, most women had one full-time profession, which was producing and raising babies, and that put them in a different situation than everybody else? Is it because, I mean, they have a lot of differences, sort of the very obvious asymmetry in marriage law comes from the fact that women get pregnant and men don't, and that means a different set of constraints. And in my other seminar, I'm discussing I like to argue that paternity testing is the stealth reproduction technology, because one of the central facts on which human societies have been based forever is it is a wise child that knows his father. That's no longer true. And you could imagine different mating patterns that really weren't viable in the past, because men wanted to know who their children were, to know who to spend their resources on, essentially, which could be viable now that we've got reliable paternity testing. So those, it's an interesting set of issues, and if you think you can do a really interesting paper on it, you know, using the things we're doing, feel free. That might be fun. It's not something I've gone into, but yeah. As I say, I guess I have some prejudice against anything that's currently in fashion. Yeah? How do people find out what the law is?
Right, especially in the complexities of like cooking law for gypsies and Jewish and Islamic law.
Yeah.
Complex cooking practices. How do you make sure that everyone, especially if it varies from region to region, how do you make sure everyone is has all the processes?
Yeah. That is, remember that most societies until modern times, people weren't very mobile. So that for most people, the fact that Sephardic and Ashkenazi rules were different didn't really matter to them, because they were only in one place or the other. People who aren't familiar, the Ashkenazi are the Yiddish-speaking Jews, mostly of Eastern Europe. The Sephardim are the Jews who speak a language based ultimately on Spanish called Ladino, who were in Spain until they were expelled, and are also in North Africa and the Middle East. And those are the two major divisions still that have been for, I guess, for a very long time, of the, but yeah, no. So that would sort of, you know, there is the claim in our system, ignorance of the law is no excuse. And you say, well, wait a minute, you people are spending lots of money and spending 3 years, and you don't expect to really know the law when you're finished. You still assume that you're ever in a real case, you're going to have to go back to the books and discover it. So how can you possibly expect an ordinary citizen to know what the law is? And that's a legitimate issue. And I think the Chinese answer, as best I understand it, is the ordinary citizen doesn't have to know what the law is. He only has to know right and wrong, because the law will punish the wrong and reward the right, and therefore, and that is one approach. And if you've got a society with a sufficiently uniform sort of normative system shared by both the rulers and the ruled, then you might be able to get away with saying, well, yes, we've got these rules, but you don't really have to read the rules, just be good and nothing will happen to you. And that obviously becomes a much more serious problem when you've got a society that mixes people with quite different mixes, gypsies and Amish and ordinary Americans, for example, with three quite different views. Yeah.
So I have another thread, but this may be right. More political than legal. And the thread is, one of the fundamental problems that societies have is you always have, or almost always have, this supreme executive authority that you need to constrain, because otherwise they can literally do whatever the hell they
yeah.
want, executing people right, left, confiscating yeah. property, etc. So the key question is, how do you control the uncontrollable?
Yeah. But that's already one of the threat chapters. That's who guards the guardians.
Yeah,
I wasn't. I don't put it explicitly in the Supreme. Yes, I agree. But that's a subset of it. I discovered, by the way, that who guards the guardians comes from a Latin poem and has nothing to do with politics or law. But we'll come back to that later, which is sort of funny. All right, other comments on this stuff? No, thank you for all of that. All right, let's go on to our gypsies, since they're our next current subject. You've now read a chunk. I put on one more chapter on the syllabus, by the way, because it occurred to me that I wasn't giving you the chapter that compares the two different gypsy legal systems, which is sort of neat, and I've got a brief summary of it in my chapter, but I figure you might as well read the real thing, and it's not a very long chapter, as it happens, from gypsy law. But from the stuff you've read so far, what were sort of points that occurred to you that seemed to you interesting, puzzling, informative, reminded you of your society, reminded you of other societies, other things that occurred to people? Nobody? Let's see. How about the whole system of pollution? What's it there for? Right? It's clearly it's a damn nuisance being a gypsy. Right? You can't wash your hands in the kitchen sink. You got to have a men's room and a ladies' room, even in a house with only one family in it. And a whole bunch of other stuff of that sort. And it makes a semi-consistent pattern that the top half of the body is clean, the bottom half is unclean. Well, in a way that fits in, that after all, lots of societies think of excretion and sex as in some sense taboo, to varying degrees taboo activities. The Yeats line, and love has pitched his temple in the place of excrement. That's from a Yeats poem. And that makes a little sense. And it also makes a little bit of functional sense, because excrement does carry disease and such, so that's a reason to worry about washing your hands after you've been to the bathroom and such. But there's an awful lot of stuff that doesn't even make sense there. And that's also true, of course, of Orthodox Judaism. It's just that the Jews are even worse. You know, if you might believe nobody could be. But yeah. I think my guess from the stuff I've read is that it's not current versus anachronistic, it's stricter versus looser. That is, remember, there isn't a gypsy ruler. There isn't a Supreme Court. You're talking first about a group that's fractionated into some very different, in a number of ways, subgroups. And within the subgroups, the really big one is the Vlachram. The Vlachram are the descendants of the Romanian gypsies. They're divided into four different nations. Each of those nations doesn't have a national ruler either. As far as I can tell, the highest level which you have any sort of a ruler is the clan, which is a much farther down subset of the nation. So I suspect what's going on is that there are some gypsy communities where they are very strict about these things, some where they're strict about doing it publicly and openly, but in private, you know, who cares kind of thing, and so forth. And I think you'll see that in many systems, that there are various medieval Islamic anecdotes from which it's perfectly clear that various caliphs drank wine. They weren't supposed to. And I'm sure there were other people who were much stricter, who really did obey all of the, every jot and tittle of the law, so to speak. And I think, and we'll see when the Amish are open about it. That is, the Amish explicitly, each congregation makes its version of the ordinum, of the rules. And they all have the same foundation, but they vary quite a lot. And they will classify different groups of congregations as higher, meaning looser, or lower, meaning stricter. And they sort of recognize that. It doesn't always go the way you might think. For example, the stricter groups are more likely to approve of smoking. Why? Because they've changed less over time, and smoking was perfectly acceptable 50 years ago. That's my guess, at least, of what's going on. So in the case, at least, of the Amish, they're pretty explicit about how it varies. But it sounded from the stuff I read as though that's been true of the gypsies as well. Yes?
Well, in the case of the pollution issue, one of the hallmarks of societies that we've studied is that if you want to preserve a group over time, a good way to do it is to come up with essentially an arbitrary and rather difficult cultural norm that has to be adhered to in order to prove your membership of the group. And you know, as long as you can do that, as long as you can build that in your core foundation group, it can continue for, I don't know, 1,000 years or more. So you could argue some of these pollution laws are deliberately annoying and irritating and hard to follow, because it's a way in which we can preserve our group identity and is surrounded by a sea of non-gypsies.
There's an economist by the name of Larry Iannacone, who used to be here and unfortunately got stolen away by George Mason University 7 years ago. Student of Gary Becker's, for those people who know who Becker was, and his specialty was economics of religion. And the first time I met Larry, actually, he gave a talk in Chicago on essentially this question. And what he was considering within the U.S. context in particular, that you have some religious groups such as Orthodox Jews, but there are a number of others, which seem to impose very strict and costly requirements on their members, and others that don't. And he was distinguishing these as, I think it was cults or sects, some term like that he used to refer to the stronger ones and then the religions which are less strong. And the question is why? And his point was that in America, we have an open market for religions. You can start your own religion tomorrow if you like. So why do the ones that impose unnecessary costs survive? Why isn't Orthodox Judaism always driven off the market by Reform or Conservative Judaism? And his answer was along your lines, although it was on a somewhat smaller scale. His argument was that if you can get a group, if you can force a group of people to have their interactions largely inward to other members of the group, That solves certain kinds of public good problems. That for a small group, it's in my interest to care about the welfare of the group. For a large group, it mostly isn't, because I have such a small effect. That's why voters don't know very much, because they're rationally ignorant. But member of a congregation of 50 people, it matters for me to know who to trust and who not to trust. It means that when somebody's facing hard times, I know whether they're really facing hard times or just trying to get a handout. And if they're really facing hard times, I'll help them. I want the reputation for doing that. Then people will see I'm a valuable member of the group, will help me when I'm in hard times, and maybe my kids if they are. So his argument was that there are a bunch of things that can be effectively done in relatively small closed groups, that in order for that to work, there's got to be a reason why I have to depend on the other members of my group rather than doing stuff in the greater society, and that you put up barriers of this sort, costly things, one of whose effects is it's hard to socialize with non-Jews if you're an Orthodox Jew, because you can't eat at their houses because their silverware isn't kosher, so to speak. And similarly for a bunch of other things. And he actually had an interesting prediction, which he tested. Larry's argument was that as a general rule in our society, higher status and higher income professions tend to involve a wider network of contacts. That if what you're doing is fixing plumbing in a six-block area might keep you busy. If you're a lawyer, you're really going to have to interact with people over a much wider area. And he therefore predicted that the cost of having these restrictions, which lock you into your own community, would be higher for high-income type professional people than low income. And he therefore predicted that the strictness of the rules would tend to correlate inversely with the income of the congregation. That higher income population groups would be less likely to be members of religious groups like this. And he claimed that it turned out to be true with one exception. The exception was the Mormons. That the Mormons are a relatively restrictive group, but they do quite well for themselves. And his explanation was the reason is the Mormons are really good at raising the income of their members, at getting people to work hard and do stuff like that. I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing were true of the black Muslims, because they, in a way, are a similar group with a lot of restrictions, but a lot of emphasis on sort of, you know, don't get drunk, don't do this, be a good, hardworking, middle-class type person at the same time that you're believing in this bizarre religion, complete with its own sort of, with Elijah Muhammad having come down as maybe God or a prophet or something like that. So, but anyway, but that was a broader version of the kind of point you're making. But I would argue, I think you're right, but I think with regard to the gypsies at least, part of the function served by these is to keep the boundaries. You wanted to say that before I go on. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to comment on this. We were talking about how strict it is for different gypsy groups. So
yep.
In a place like Romania, which is such a high percentage of the population, gypsy, that you have in any one community a wide range. You know, you have people that are, there's so much pressure, especially in Eastern Europe, to assimilate.
You're familiar with that society?
I live in Romania.
Great.
So I know, just from personal experience, I know people that are gypsy that were very closed off, and then in the same community, in the same city, gypsies that lived a very modern lifestyle and very much were assimilated.
Yeah.
Were not for the fact that they're openly discriminated against.
Yep.
In a lot of respects. That they would just be another part of
the society. And you think that that second group largely ignored the Maramé rules?
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I mean, there was, if you look at pop culture there, they have a lot of music videos. And the popular music in Romania, for example, is music called Manele, which is, sounds like reggaeton, but it's just gypsy music. That's been commercialized, and it has women scantily clad, gypsy women, just dancing all over the place. And so I think, from my understanding, that would kind of not go.
Sounds dubious,
yeah. Doesn't really work with this line. But so I'm curious how that works in, say, a country like Austria, which is, has a different set of rules, or Hungary, which is right next to it.
Yes.
And have similar gypsy populations, but have different kind of enforcement mechanisms for assimilating them into their culture. And I think that's kind of a different.
One of the issues that occurred to me, and I was sort of thinking in part of the gypsies and the Amish as an interesting contrast, because in a way the gypsies and the Amish are very similar, that, you know, they're both of them have their own language, both of them have relatively small unit groups, they're dispersed, and the Amish are only in the U.S. and Canada, whereas the gypsies have been much more successful in that sense, and yet they look very different in other ways, and that when I was thinking about the gypsies, it seemed to me that part of the reason their law enforcement system worked was precisely the fact that they were cut off. The fact that both the gypsies thought all the rest of the people were polluted, and the non-gypsies disliked the gypsies and didn't trust them. Therefore, if you were expelled from your gypsy community, you had nowhere to go. And from that standpoint, it seemed to me that the situation in North America, which are relatively tolerant societies, might eventually destroy the gypsy system. Because we were tolerant enough that if they try to enforce their rules on their own members, people who don't like it, who are on the losing end of it, will just succeed into the greater culture, and that'll weaken their control. But then I started looking at the Amish. Nobody hates the Amish, right? The Amish, you know, we think they're a tourist attraction. We think of them as, you know, we can't live up to their standards, and it's a little bit weird the way they do without cars, but they have a generally positive image, I would say, in American culture. And in fact, if you look at the history, as we'll be seeing when you read the Amish chapter, the Amish have been surprisingly successful in getting the surrounding society to make exceptions for them. Amish kids can leave school in eighth grade. Amish get to make their own one-room schools taught by Amish teachers who have only had an eighth-grade education, and in most states, though not always, they can get away with it. The rules that normally apply to them don't apply to them. Part of the reason is they've got great PR. All right? But one result is that it's very easy to leave being an Amish. Not only does the surrounding society not hate you, but there are the groups closely related to the Amish, the Mennonites in particular, who are natural refugees. There are people who are rather like you, but less extreme. So there's sort of a natural, smooth path out of being Amish, so to speak. But it only about 10 to 20% of the Amish each generation take it. Yeah.
Is it all Amish communities, or some Amish communities allow the Amish?
Rumspringa. Some. Rumspringa is a common but not a universal pattern. The Rumspringa, for those not familiar with it, is the idea that roughly teenagers are allowed to run wild a little bit, that they can go into town and go to movies, and if they're not too obvious about it, they can drive cars and maybe even own a car, again, if they're not too obvious about it to their parents and such. So it's a sort of an idea of youth being a little bit, sowing their wild oats, so to speak. Now, my impression from reading about it is that mostly it's done with other Amish, that mostly you're going to have a party, you're going to a movie, but they probably don't have non-Amish girlfriends and boyfriends and things of that sort. So that it's not that free, but it's still relatively free in many but not all Amish communities. And there is the argument which says, look, we're letting them see what the world is like, and by God, our community is better. I mean, that's sort of what the Amish would put it. There's an 18th century poem I'm quite fond of called An English Padlock. And it's a jealous husband talking to his friend about how he'll keep his wife faithful. And he's going through more and more extreme things, none of which are going to work. And the friend keeps explaining why they won't work. And finally, he goes, is there nothing I can do? He says, yeah, let her go. Let her see how corrupt this world of seducers and all the rest of it is. And she's going to come back to you and want it to be faithful. So let all her ways be unconfined and set your padlock on her mind. Is the end of it. And it's sort of a neat poem. I wrote a takeoff on it. I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago when it was having student troubles. And it happened that I was auditing an 18th century English poetry class taught, which covered this poem. And that the professor who was doing it was the chairman of the committee of the Council of the Faculty Senate. So he was sort of within the university self-government system. He was near the peak at the time these things were happening. So I wrote him a poem that was a takeoff on An English Padlock. Telling the solution to student disruption was to turn the university over to the students so they'd make a real mess of running things and would desperately ask you to come back and so forth. So it's a neat poem anyway. Yes?
Well, can I say, I think that Amish comparison is pretty accurate to what I experienced as an observer living around 50.
How long were you in Romania, by the way?
7 months.
Yeah. Do you speak the language?
Yeah.
Neat. Yeah. All right. Continue. I like to exploit my students. So, yeah. If you know stuff, it's great. Yeah. Right. That's it.
No, I would say that there's also a racial element too. Because yep. If you're Amish, you want to assimilate, and you have, you know, they don't have bizarre last names, so you just one generation off, and you're taken yep. into society. And
right.
In Romania, it's a lot different because there's a lot of. I don't know. I want to say there's about 5% that's Gypsy identifies, and probably another 10% actually. They just don't identify as Gypsy, or they're part, you know, yep. Romanian. And it's easier for them because Romanians are kind of dark, but in places, once you start moving up into further in Northern Europe, you can see the contrast. So if you're a second generation Gypsy, you still look darker. And I think a lot of that's changing now, too, with the amount of Turkish people that are coming into Western Europe. Mm-hmm. It's a huge change in the, you know, now you see if you go to Holland, a huge percent of the population is darker.
Yes.
Not just certainly the Moroccans. And they have an easier time kind of sneaking into the system, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because you have other brown people around.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of made it a little bit easier, and it kind of eases that pressure. And as you said, the society has become more and more tolerant of Turkish people, and they become more and more tolerant of the gypsies that are behaving the way they want.
Of course, it could also be the other way. They could become more tolerant of the gypsies because they're not Turks.
Yeah, and that's what you might call it, tolerance.
Well, it's tolerance on one side. Yeah. I was thinking of the degree to which to which Orthodox Jews and conservative Christians are allies in modern American politics. Neither of them is Muslims, and neither of them is atheists. Right? And I think that kind of pattern does happen, that when you have the more foreigners come in, as it were, that at least some of the time the result is that the only moderately foreigners suddenly become locals. So going back, so one possible explanation of what's going on with the gypsies is that these are patterns that work because they draw sharp lines around you. And the Amish certainly do things to draw lines. They wear special clothing, for example. But they're clear symbolic lines, but it's not clear that they are as substantive lines as the ones are for the gypsies, both because the gypsies have internalized these ideas, many of them, the sort of orthodox ones, so to speak, have internalized these ideas of marame, so they don't want to deal with non-gypsies and get polluted, and at the same time the non-gypsies have internalized the hostility to gypsies, and that, again, keeps the gypsies separate. And you could think of these things either from a sort of design standpoint or from an evolution standpoint. You might say, well, some clever people among the gypsies said we've got to keep these rules in order to keep our people together. Or you could say, well, there have been lots of societies in the history of the world. The ones that didn't have rules like this didn't keep together. And ones which had somewhat rules like this, the non-Orthodox flaked off, and what they left was the core of Orthodox, so to speak. And I think you can see that in the Amish case, because in the Amish case, they do lose. Each generation, about 10 to 20% of the kids don't end up Amish. And that's been true for quite a long time. So you can see a pattern, as it were, where the less Orthodox people leave, and you're left with the ones who are following a pattern that maintains itself. So, in addition, we've got this weird system of, to me, weird, to most of us, I think, weird systems of taboos, and you then have, how is it enforced? And partly it's enforced by belief, by what non-members think of as superstition, but it's at least a little unclear how different that is from the way in which a lot of our behavior is enforced, because we think of certain things as wicked and therefore don't do them. Although in their case, it's not just that being polluted is bad, they also think it's literally bad. It hurts you, and you'll get sick, you might die, you have bad luck. And you can see that pattern. One of the societies that I've covered in some past years but decided to leave out this year is the Cheyenne Indians. And the Cheyenne Indians, if you kill another Cheyenne, they have the kind of society where there's a good deal of casual physical violence. But if you kill another Cheyenne, you're out of the tribe. Why are you out of the tribe? Not because you're wicked, because maybe you had a good reason to. Because you smell of death. And other people who are close to you are going to come to smell of death too, and they're going to be unlucky, and bad things are going to happen. And therefore, when you have killed another Cheyenne, you're automatically, as well, there's a legal process, it's a formal process, but it looks as though you don't have the option of saying it was self-defense or the equivalent. In 5 or 10 years, you might get back in, because the smell of death has gotten weaker. But if you're ever readmitted, for the rest of your life, nobody will ever share your pipe or eat from your bowl, because it still might be catching, as it were. So that's an interesting one mechanism for enforcing these things, is that kind of belief, where people have factual beliefs in which bad things will happen if you violate the rules, and that's a reason not to violate the rules. Yeah?
On that idea of smell of death, is it possible that because that's a tribe that tribes of large extent, or composed of large extent of humans, that someone who murders another person in the tribe is going to be retaliation?
That would be true of the Comanche,
It's not clear to me it's going to be true of the Cheyenne. That would be... What is true is that when you ask to be readmitted in 5 or 10 years, it helps a whole lot of the kin of the person you kill improve if you're doing so. So in that sense, so maybe you're right. Maybe that's evidence in favor of trying to avoid feud systems. But all I can always say is Cheyenne doesn't really feel very much like a feud system when you read the book about it. But it's a system which is beginning to develop a government but hasn't gotten all that far, whereas the Comanche are a pure anarchist system. Yeah.
This is kind of interesting. How does a person who's been expelled survive, or where does he go?
He goes to other tribes. The Cheyenne at this period are in the Great Plains. There are several other tribes with similar lifestyles. I'm not sure if their language is mutually comprehensible, or if you have to learn their language. But it sounds as though it's perfectly normal for someone who is expelled to then go somewhere else. Maybe he marries somebody from another tribe, lives with them for a while, but may eventually come back. And there are various references in the sources to that kind of pattern. So that's one way. A closely related one is the belief that violating the rules is disgusting. And again, if you think about how we enforce various of our norms, part of it is that certain things you just don't do. Those are all sort of internal enforcements. And then one of the questions is why do people keep believing these things, especially if the belief is costly, if the belief constrains your activity, why don't some people say, well, actually washing your hands in the kitchen sink doesn't cause anything bad to happen, it never caused anything bad to happen to me, and more people do that. So that's a potential issue. Another way you enforce it is through decentralized actions by other people. And other people shun you if you're observed not to conform to the norms, or maybe they semi-shun you, or they don't like doing business with you, or they won't let you marry their daughter, or various other things of that sort. And one reason is because they believe in the system. But another sort of interesting one is the self-consistent, the sort of lifting yourself by the bootstraps version, which is why do I shun you when you break the rules? Because not shunning a rule breaker is itself a breaking of the rules, and other people will shun me. So you have a sort of a self-consistent system all running on itself, if that makes any sense. And I think I should say a good deal of this, I think you can see in our society. The particular case that occurred to me this morning thinking about it was the Ron Paul newsletters. I don't know if you people have been following these stories, but Ron Paul is a moderately successful, though he's probably not going to make it, candidate for the Republican nomination. And it turns out that a fair while back, some newsletters which were published under his names but had articles written by various people had stuff in it which is routinely described as racist. Now, I've read some of it, and the question, I guess, is how you define racist. It is certainly racially hostile. That is to say, I don't think the things I saw didn't say blacks have lower IQs than whites or blacks are inherently evil. But they said, if you want to know, you know, how fast a black teenager can run, get mugged and you'll see. And I don't remember if that's the... But things like that. So it was clearly targeted at people who were mad at blacks, as it were. And that's causing him serious political costs now. So it's not illegal to write that sort of thing. You can write much worse things than that without getting in trouble with the law. And yet, if you're going to do something where widespread approval matters to you, it is prudent, even if you believe those things, not to say them in public. And I wonder, you try to engage in a little introspection and think whether there are any views that you have and might be willing to discuss with a close friend that you would be very prudent, very, very, very reluctant to state somewhere where they were publicly visible, in the equivalent of a newsletter, on a web page, say. Because I can certainly think of things I believe which I would feel that way about. I suspect that most of us, if you really think about it, would be different things for different people. I had a conversation with somebody I know on the East Coast where she was quite explicitly saying that she, on the whole, preferred other living things to human beings, and therefore thought that if the result of a larger human population was less biological diversity, better that fewer people exist. Well, it's not an indefensible position, and a lot of people who criticize environmentalists suspect that's what environmentalists really believe but won't say. But on the whole, if I were an environmentalist, I would be reluctant to say that in print. Because it's too, and you can think of much more extreme cases. Another case which I find sort of interesting. How many of you have ever heard of H.L. Mencken? A few. Mencken, in the first half of the 20th century, was one of the most widely read newspaper writers and essayists. If you were sort of a intellectually ambitious and progressive 23-year-old, you not only wanted to read Mencken, you wanted to be known to read Mencken, because he was the person people like that read. Walter Lippmann at one point described him as the most powerful man in America, in an intellectual sense, as it were. He's a very good writer. I'm an admirer of his. He sort of is a cynic and sarcastic and exaggerates a whole lot. And, you know, he said that democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard, for example. But some years ago, Mencken's diaries got published. Now, the fact they were published itself, in my view, is a violation of at least norms, because Mencken had left them with a library on the condition that they be available for scholars to look at after a certain date. And after that date passed, somebody actually published them. And there was a big flap over people saying, look, this proves that Mencken was a racist and an anti-Semite and a bigot. And it just isn't true if you read the things. What's true is that he was writing at a time in which the norms of language were very different than they are now. So he, for example, he refers to a couple of Jewish women as kikes. It's clear in context what he means is these women fit the anti-Semitic stereotype of what some Jewish women are like. But at the same time, when he's accused of this, a whole bunch of Jewish friends came and said, what do you mean he's anti-Semitic? You know, he helped me get a job. One of the interesting things is there was a fairly prominent black newspaper man at the time. And Mencken went to considerable efforts to try to persuade his newspaper to hire the guy. And wrote somewhere that he was not only a better reporter, but a more courageous reporter than 99% of the white reporters. He did not succeed. They did not hire him. But I think his daughter was one of the people who then testified in Mencken's favor. And you read through the thing, and it's clear on the one hand that he's less prejudiced than most of us are. That if you look at it, he takes everybody as he meets. So there's this wonderful anecdote at one point where he's gone to visit a friend who lives out in the countryside, and the friend sends his chauffeur to pick him up from the railroad station. This is 1920s or something. Chauffeur is an uneducated black man who Mencken finds to be intelligent and a really interesting guy. And he enjoyed the conversation, seeing what the world looked like from this person's standpoint. Next time he goes to visit the friend, he's looking forward to the conversation with the chauffeur. But unfortunately, there's another guest who is a white woman, and the chauffeur won't open his mouth when she's around. And Mencken is disappointed. But this is a famous man, and yet, this is a guy who formerly is a very low status, smart guy, interesting guy, let's talk with him. So as I say, my impression is he's less prejudiced than I think I am, and probably than most of you are, more willing to take people as he finds them. But he uses words. And therefore you can select things. Different set of norms, different time. So my point really is that a lot of this sort of enforcement through decentralized action you can see around you in things we do. What else? We're just about out of time anyway. Legal system is an oral law. Oral law, sort of interesting. Apparently one of the things some of the gypsies offer as evidence that their system is better than ours is that theirs doesn't change and ours keeps changing, so they must have got it right. But of course they don't really know if theirs changes or not, because there are no written records of it, and presumably if it changes quietly. We've always done things that way, right? Again, one observes that, I think, in other societies as well. And the nearest thing they have to a real court is the Cris Romani. And again, that is not applied to all gypsy groups. It applies to the Velotrom and maybe some of the others. I'm not sure, but explicitly not to all of them. And it's unclear to me to what degree the judges are really deciding. It's somewhat unclear how the judges are being chosen, other than that the elders of the various families involved in the process. But it's a procedure for basically, as far as you can tell, reaching a consensus, which could be anything from he has committed a capital offense, we're going to kill him, which is not going to happen very much nowadays because it's sort of risky to kill people. You might end up in court. To you must do X, Y, and Z, or else you will have a sentence of marame and we will consider you polluted and won't associate with you. And all of those things can happen. One thing I hadn't noticed before, but I noticed rereading it, is that for those outcomes that involve fines, the fine is on the lineage, not just on the individual. that is to say, the lineage presumably being his kin within some degree. And that's interesting, because that pattern also shows up in both the Somali and the Irish cases, that you observe that in some cases, either the fine is supposed to be paid by the offender, but if he doesn't pay, his close relatives are responsible for it. Or in the Somali case, that there are some rules for dividing up the fines among the relatives so that it's not all supposed to be paid by the person in question. So that was sort of intriguing. And what else? Sort of interesting to see how it's being affected by the host system, but also how it protects itself against the host system. That it sounds as though, I think I have the comment somewhere in the chapter, that the fact that the estimate of the number of gypsies is between 3 million and 15 million is not an accident. It's a result of the fact that the gypsies don't want to be counted, and that they therefore act in various ways that make it harder for governments to keep track of them, which is a prudent thing to do if you want to run your own system. Yeah. And the travelers I have not studied. The travelers are an interesting case because they're not really gypsies in any ethnic sense, but they have a somewhat similar pattern. And the answer is no. But that would be, if you would get enough information, that would be a good paper to do a paper on the travelers. And I think there may be some other. I think tinkers are a different group than the travelers, but again, one which follows a sort of a semi-migratory kind of pattern. So if I'm right that the tinkers and the travelers are different people, and I think they are, those would both be interesting things to compare to the gypsies and maybe even to the Amish. I have not looked at those, but those are fun ones. If I looked at everything, what would people do? Great. All right, well, I think...